trees pass, and and you, we feel like, well, okay, this is good, and you know, okay, we accept it, and you know, we want to follow God, and then, but we don't have that feeling of seeing it in front of our eyes, a person who is the manifestation of these things.
True.
And then somebody like Imam comes, and you get it. You're like, oh my God, I get it. This is it. He is the, he is one of the manifestations. Again, you know, we're not saying he's Masoom. We're not saying he's the prophet or he's. No. What we're saying is he's very close in terms of
that
in level. Terms of his personality and his piety.
His piety.
His personal life.
His righteousness. Yes.
And also he's close to that in terms of being a leader of people, being a leader of the ummah, of being a leader of humanity.
Sure.
So these aspects combined in Imam. And we saw it, and we felt it. And this is why you see that in the most difficult time, maybe, in the history of Iran, in terms of standing up to, and remember, you know, the Shah was a powerful government.
Well, this is
with
the
full
point.
Backing of America,
of
having
course.
The, you know, being one of the most important clients of the U.S.
Absolutely.
With tens of thousands of American advisors, you know.
It was very
being
rare.
In Iran, being actually the ones that were controlling Iran. It was a form of colonialism.
Yeah.
They didn't call it colonialism.
No.
But it was a form of colonialism where you had, you know, 50,000-60,000 American advisors spread out through the country in all the key areas.
Mm.
And they were the ones making the decisions.
Well, this is what I wanted to point out, that it was very rare to find a country, apart from Turkey, being a member of NATO. And we've discussed that many times in other programs. But Iran was strategically more important to the United States than even Turkey, because you could tell that the most advanced weaponry, apart from whatever Israel was getting, the most advanced weaponry actually were delivered was delivered to Iran before it went to Israel.
Right, and had a very important strategic place
for
the U.S. And of course, the U.S. also put, you know, supported the Shah in that way.
Sure.
Now imagine, you know,
all that reversed.
Right. This is it's a big deal. It's not a small feat.
No, it was not a small feat.
And you know, it was Imam and it was the people, you know, who followed him and who trusted him. And he trusted them. This is very important. We have a problem among the elites in the world. And this is religious, non-religious, Islamic. They
very
don't
good.
Trust the people.
No.
They have an arrogant view towards the people. Okay? This is the important thing about Imam, which really distinguishes him, and I hope to speak more about this when we continue.
It's an excellent point you're making.
You know, Imam as a leader, okay? The majority, the vast majority of leaders, and it makes no difference what background they're from, they don't trust the people. They look down on the people. It could be subtle. It could be overt. It could be in a way that, well, you know, let's trust the people who are the experts. And yet Imam wasn't like that.
No.
Imam trusted the people because for him, the standard was Iman, was
faith.
You know, somebody,
beautiful.
You know, it's
point.
Not simply about your ilm. Ilm is important.
No, ilm is important.
Your knowledge
faith
is
more
okay,
important.
So here he is. He looks at a society. I'm talking about Iran now at the time of the revolution, before the revolution.
Sure.
You know, the majority are illiterate. You know, 40% literacy, 60% illiteracy.
Yes.
You look at them and you're like, well, what can we do with these people? You know, who are these, you know, these peasants, these, you know, toilers of the of the world in the cities and the factories? These, you know, immigrants from these migrants from the countryside living in slums, you know? What can we do? And yet Imam trusts them. And he empowers them. And he awakens them spiritually. And they turn into a force that overthrows the most powerful ruler and regime in the region with the American backing. And then, after this is done, they establish something miraculous. It's a republic. It's got elections.
Yes, you know? As you're having them now.
Right.
As well.
You know, you have a parliament elected by the people. You have a presidency, or at that time, you know, a prime minister. You know,
complete dismantlement of whatever was there
you
before.
You have a complete dismantlement of that imperial feudal culture.
Yeah.
You know?
That's an amazing thing.
Now, some people are upset about that. They go, "We want that feudal imperial culture."
Trust me. There are many people.
And you know, you look at, for example, a lot of British elites.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
We very much have that kind of mentality.
Who are like, well, we need to have classes, and we need to have, you know, royalty and
in order to serve their own
and we need to have an aristocracy, and we have a natural aristocracy, and this is the people that have to lead a nation, and then, you know, you have the workers.
Yes, as if man was evolved to serve in that capacity.
And so it's a belief, an idea that you have to have, you know, a lord, and then you have to have peasants and vassals and
the
commoners.
Serfs.
So this is a it's not, you know, it's not only in Iran, it's not only in, like, you know, the despotic Eastern, you know, Orientalism, you know, like you had in the Westerners always talking. You have this also in the West.
Of course.
Okay, some of them being, you know, straight up aristocratic, like in Britain, having dukes and earls and other. And then you have it the capitalist version of it in places like the US, where it's a money aristocracy.
That's right.
Okay. Absolutely. Now, here comes Imam, okay, in the land of the kings, of the Persian kings, you know,
who 2,500 years,
where you literally had feudal lords. I'm not talking about 100 years ago. You had lords owning peasants, and owning, you know, vast areas of land. You know, educated in the best universities and having nothing to do with the normal people, living in their own little, bubble.
Bubble.
Yeah. You know, being Western elites, going to Ascot, you know.
Yes, absolutely.
You know what I mean?
We saw them.
You know? Going to the casino of you know, Beirut casino or whatever, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he just completely puts that away. And he empowers the people who are illiterate, who are peasants, but who are honest and who have real faith in God, and who are willing to sacrifice everything they have for their dignity. You see, this is the thing. Right now, you have a country like the Islamic Republic. You know, there's a lot of problems with these pressures and the sanctions and the propaganda and the lies and all the things that were, you know, pulled through the mud every day.
Sure.
In the Western media. And yet, what is the thing that distinguishes the Islamic Republic? It is the thing that distinguishes it. It has dignity. It has independence. It is, you know, nobody's fool. It doesn't have to ask permission of the Americans or of whoever, the Chinese or the Soviets or you know,
or whoever,
to conduct its own affairs. It makes its own decisions about what is its national interests. It doesn't subsume its national interests and the interests of its people to the economic and strategic needs of America or Israel,
you bring up
like Egypt did for so many years.
That's right.
These old guys in the Persian Gulf states, you know, who the only thing they care about is having their family have the billions in the bank.
That's right. They're trying.
Who cares about the people? And let's just bring in some, you know, slave labor, some serf labor, some wage slaves from, you know, Bangladesh and India to run the affairs.
Well, I mean, what I was going to say
was... You know, this is not what Iran did.
Yeah, this is what I was going to say was that, you know, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, says that right from the beginning. He's quoted in every newspaper across the world saying this, and I remember this, that he said that, you know, a powerful and independent Iran is better. He was addressing the Iranian people, of course, and he said it's a better thing for you in the long run than being subservient to anyone.
Exactly, and this is a problem that, you know, it's so ingrained in this part of the world because of imperialism, colonialism, because I'm not talking only political and military.
No, it's a very
economic,
serious problem.
Cultural indoctrination of the education systems, which are basically Western in many countries.
Because many Muslim countries can't get out of this.
Right. They feel like, well, better to be, you know, an appendage.
Yeah, appendage.
You know, living in a golden cage.
Yeah.
You know, having our, you know, luxury cars. I'm talking about the elites.
Remember, elites, yes.
We're always talking about the elites here.
Because
you know,
you've talked about the fact that the people have no place in
right.
this thing. Yeah.
And yet in Iran, that's different.
That's different.
There, it's a different feel of it. Yes. You know, it doesn't mean that there aren't elites. It doesn't mean that there are not rich people. It just means that the normal people are not forgotten. They're not forgotten.
No.
Not only are they not forgotten.
But they're the most...
They're part of it.
They're
and
part
I,
of it.
I mentioned, for example, Parliament. More important than even parliamentary elections is local, village, and city council elections. These cities and the towns and the villages all across Iran, from, you know, Azari speaking in the north northwest to Baluchi speaking in the southeast, from the Arab speaking in the south,
Khuzestan, of
course, you know, to the, you know, Central Asian Khorasan, you know. All villages and towns in Iran have their own councils elected by their own people. This is big. It's huge.
They don't have that in China.
I mean, it's massive.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a massive revolution. We're talking about, you know, on the grassroots level, people who were illiterate and peasants, you know, a generation ago. Their children are educated, you know, are running their own affairs. They themselves, some of them, were able to get educated and literate and run their own affairs. And
that's, you know, a dramatic change.
You know, this is massive. Why would you want to deny that? Mm. Are there problems? Of course there are problems. Every country has problems.
Sure.
You know, isn't there problems in local elections in the U.S., in the counties and...
yeah, in the U.K., yes.
You know,
of
in the U.K.
are.
Aren't, you know... There are always problems, you know, in these...
Sure. But the thing is that the development, the extraordinary development as a result of the impact that Imam Khomeini made on Iran,
exactly,
is extraordinary. There's roads, there's electricity, there's
I'm
running
talking
water.
About beyond, I mean, beyond the physical things is the idea, which is what Imam did.
The idea, yes. Absolutely.
He said, you are worthy as human beings because of your faith.
Absolutely.
Not because you were born as a peasant or because you were, you know, a
because
certain,
this comes right
certain
out
ethnic
of the
group
Holy Quran,
or a certain,
yeah,
you know, racial background, which existed at that time in Iran. There was a lot of ethnic problems.
Of course there were.
And there was a lot of, you know, ethnic discrimination.
Of course there were.
And linguistic discrimination. And he said to all Iranians, and again, Shia and Sunni.
Shia and Sunni, that was also important.
Even the Christians and the...
Yes, of
he
course.
Never said, you know, leave or, you know...
No.
One of the first things he said...
They have seats in parliament,
right?
They
have, you know, one of the first things he said is that you're part of this society and this is because of Islam. Because Islam teaches us that we all, everybody has rights that have to be, you know, respected. Mm-hmm. So, here's a man who you know, enlivened these people, these humans... told them that they have dignity, and they responded in kind. Mm. And here you've transformed a nation where those people are now all able to influence their destiny in terms of, you know, making the decisions that are important in their lives, whether it's as part of the local and the regional political decision-making processes, or it's as just informed citizens. Literate, educated, being able to discuss things, you know, this is a big thing. And the beginning of it was Imam.
Exactly.
And his devotion and his complete...
surrender to God.
To God and belief in God's plan as being the correct thing.
As the correct
Not
thing.
The other isms and all the different schools, like, oh, in order to become civilized, we have to become European. This was a big, huge, you know, thing that they used to talk about in Iran before the revolution is that, you know, imagine this, a nation which is the cradle of civilization, one of the cradles of civilization,
sure,
saying that you have to become European in order to become civilized. I mean, how shameful is that?
It was a disgrace.
It was a disgrace, okay? Mm. Imitating, aping, you know, Western lifestyles and ways of being and,
sure,
you know.
It's such a proud history.
Right. And then because you think, well, this is what makes us humans. You know, as long as some, you know, British or French person pats us on the shoulder and says, oh, you're a good guy, that makes us, you know, a real human. And this is so against the Quran. If you look at the Quran,
yes, absolutely.
We talk about Izzah, right? Izzah is dignity, it's power, it's you know.
And it comes from God.
And it says it's only from God.
Only from God.
And this is what the elites didn't understand, and still some of the elites in the Muslim world
don't understand.
They
don't
think that if the Americans say that they're good, that means they're good. And, I'm specifically referring, for example, let's say, just as an example, you know, the gentleman in Turkey today.
A gentleman in Turkey,
right.
Yes. I mean, I thought we were going in that direction.
Yeah, I mean, who claim to be Islamic and who have their nice little Islamic mustaches, but, you know, they're just waiting for the Americans to
pat them on the back.
Right. And so this is a problem. You know, and this was a major problem in Iran, and Imam broke all of that. Here he was on his own terms, which were God's terms, and, you know, as the flag bearer, as the standard bearer, as the leader of this movement, which was, you know, a divine movement, and for Islam, saying, you know, the truth is here, in Islam.
Islam.
Don't be ashamed of it. You know, use it. This
be
is
proud of being Muslim.
This is the thing that God gave you so that you could advance, and it gave it to all of humanity. And he, you know, he was not a racist person. He was not a person.
No.
He loved humanity. He wanted everybody
to
benefit from it. He was never saying to non-Iranians or non-Muslims that you shouldn't have. He said this is for all of us because he understood humanity as one. This is why, for example, he sends the letter to Gorbachev at that time.
Well, we'll speak more about that in another session. But thanks very much, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, for your contribution today on the man who changed the world. Of course, there's so much to say. But it just leaves me to say for the moment, Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much for listening today. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you very much.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by famous Iranian Shiite orator and lecturer, Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
این وجود مقدس رو ما اینجوری میشناسیمش ماها که شیعه هستیم
We as the Shia Muslims believe that the promised last savior of the world was born and has been alive during all these years. We believe in his holy character in this way. This is why we believe in the Ahlul Bayt, visit their tombs and ask them to ask Allah to answer our prayers. In other words, all the Shia Muslims believe that the system and the house of Ahlul Bayt is the same as the divine one and nothing else.
که امام صادق فرمود ولایتنا ولایت الله ولایت ما همون ولایت خداست
As Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam also stated, our wilaya is the wilaya of Allah, or our guardianship is the guardianship of Allah. This sentence of Imam As-Sadiq means that if a person is under the custody of the Ahlul Bayt, he or she is under the custody of Allah. In fact, Ahlul Bayt practice the orders of Allah on earth. Thus, if we as the Shias ask the Ahlul Bayt to help us, is because we believe they are truthful vicegerent of Allah on earth. This is completely different from what the Wahhabis believe in the Shias. They say that the Shias believe in their Imams as God. This is false. The Shias believe that the Ahlul Bayt were the true servants of Allah on earth, and their souls are very much closer to Allah, so in their prayers and supplications, they ask them to ask Allah to answer their prayers. In other words, Imams of the Ahlul Bayt are the link and bridge between the people and Allah, because the Ahlul Bayt were the true vicegerent of Allah on earth. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Fi amanallah.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran, all big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing, wherein we discuss problems, issues, and other relevant questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. As usual, all of our answers are based upon the Holy Quran and the narrations of the Prophet and of the household of the Prophet, peace be upon them all. Joining us in the studio is our guest speaker, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musa, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, I welcome you, and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid. Today's topic is a continuation of now the previous session's themes about the 26 rules to follow when we want to discipline our children. And we left off at the rule number 9. Please enlighten us, dear Sayyid.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajuh. When we look at discipline, as we said, there has to be rules in place and the principles that we have to adhere to make sure that we don't do the wrong thing. And we got up to number 9. With number 9 is that we need to speak to the child, convince the child of why parent need to take action? Why he needs to be disciplined?
So this after the punishment or
before? No, this punishment? Is before.
Okay.
So before the punishment, the child needs to be convinced, why is it necessary for him to be punished? For example, if I want to take the PlayStation from them or device from them, right? I say to them, look, you have to be asleep by 8. If you're not sleeping by 8 o'clock, I'm going to take a device. Why? Because of 1, 2, 3, for example. It will affect your school, it will do this, it will do that. So it's a process of convincing them why a punishment needs to take place.
So reason and also try to convince them.
Exactly. So it needs to happen before the child does the mistake and punishment. Because sometimes you'll find out that parents, they hit their children, they punish their children, and then they explain to them why they punish them.
After the fact.
After they punish them. We say, no, that should happen before the punishment, not after. So before the punishment takes place, you explain to them why a punishment need to happen and what's the purpose for it. So the child could understand the mistake itself
and reflect on
and he could avoid it himself before it even happens.
Right.
And sometimes what that itself creates is that the child may be in front of you, he's not doing the mistake, but he might do it behind your back.
Right.
But if you explain it up front and you tell him why is it dangerous, why is it bad, and why punishment might happen if that happens, it might even make him prevent him or her from doing the mistake on their own privacy when the parents are not around.
Right.
So we said it has to be, you need to explain to them why it needs to happen and the reasons for it and why it is important, but before a mistake happens, not after the mistake, which is a very important point. It needs to happen before
the punishment, you mean?
The punishment needs to happen before. No, we're saying that we need to talk to them, convince them why a punishment needs to happen before they make the mistake.
Right.
Not after they make a mistake and we punish them and then we tell them why they've been punished.
So they can perhaps associate in a good manner the mistake that they made with the punishment that will follow.
Exactly. Right? So they up front, they know what's going on. They know the mistake itself. They know the punishment of a mistake. And this is what, like, for example, even if you look at the Quran, for example, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when he talks to people, he said, like, you know what, do this and everything is cool. You don't do this, then this is the consequences.
Right.
And Allah hasn't punished us yet. We could have been doing these mistakes, right?
Right.
And Allah hasn't punished me. He says, if you pray, I will reward you this. If you don't pray, I will give you that. And sometimes I don't pray. Is Allah punishing me? No. But
not
now
yet.
I know, though.
Right.
It's up to me to make the choice.
Right. And on that note, dear listeners, we will take a quick break.
When I was born, the first words that I had heard were the words of Allah being whispered through my ear. And as I felt Allah's presence in my soul, that day Islam took me in its fold.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we're discussing the 26 rules to follow when you want to discipline our children. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
Okay. Number 10. When we want to discipline children, we have to keep in mind that using extreme violence is absolutely forbidden for two reasons. All right. There are many reasons, but I just want to use two. One, because we are 10 times stronger than them.
At the very least.
Yeah, at the very least. Or maybe at least twice or three times taller than them.
Right.
Right? Right. So you are a giant compared to a little kid, a little child. And he will see you as a giant too. Because when we're kids, we always look at things and we see them bigger than what they actually are because of the size of the eye. So he looks at you as a giant. And when you are in this position, you feel so empowered that sometimes you could create so much damage to the child. Okay, now, we're saying hitting is a wrong thing. Causing them bodily harm is a wrong thing, yes.
Right.
But let's assume you got in the mood of doing it. Make sure it is not extreme. For example, some parents, they see their children next to them and they do something and they just hit them with the feet, right? They just give them that.
Right.
As we call rafsa in Arabic,
yeah.
They just shred away, they just push them so hard with their feet that the child would fly away from the couch, fly away from somewhere, right? Yes. And it just, so we're saying number 10, that using extreme violence is absolutely forbidden. And we said, I mean, Islamically, there are diya to be paid. There are penalties that a father need to be paid. So that needs to be kept in mind. So, because some parents, they go into, I've seen parents, even when it comes to screaming, sometimes you have a normal scream, and sometimes you have a historical scream.
Right.
They go in a hysteria, the parents. And even the parents, sometimes they get in such a hysteria that they themselves, they start to break things around them. Yes. They get so violent that they start to damage things within their, within their, I don't know,
they lose control over themselves.
Yeah, so we're saying that's extreme violence. This kind of violence is not allowed whatsoever.
So when it comes to
discipline your child.
It's a reiteration. Hitting is wrong, but hitting in an extreme, excessive manner is even more wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But this, perhaps this step rule is for people who have anger issues and they want to like work on themselves, they can tone it down.
No,
right?
So the thing is, like, we have people who have anger issues, and I think some of the points we mentioned before covers it.
Right.
But this is with people that have violence themselves. Because sometimes some people, their nature, they're kind of violent themselves.
That's how they were raised. Sometimes.
Yeah, they were raised violently. So they constantly violent. And that person, once you trigger them, they're not going to be an angry person who's going to yell at you or hit you. They're going to be a person with violence. So you try to avoid them as much as you can. You know, like in school, we call them, for example, we have bullies, right? There are kids who might cause you harm, right? But there are bullies that their nature is just to come and cause you harm.
Right.
And so they have this kind of extreme violence. This is the
need that they have.
Yeah, so these are the people that we're trying to avoid as much as we can. So if a parent finds out that himself, that I know a lot of parents. I know a lot of parents with this category very well.
Right.
And they just, I don't know whether they were raised violently or not, but they have this extreme violence that when child talks to them, extreme violence comes out of them.
They freak out. Absolutely freak out. And on that intimidating note, I might add, we will take a quick break.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, "He who has a child must treat him in a childish manner."
Welcome back to your listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we're discussing the 26 rules to follow when disciplining our children. Dear Sayyid, please enlighten us further.
All right, so number 11, a parent needs to make sure that when he wants to punish a child or discipline a child, that they need to take prerequisites, that it has to be a beginning and there has to be an end that is very clear to the child. For example, a parent might say to the child in a form of discipline, "You're not allowed to go out."
Right.
That's just a statement that I remember, I give you examples that I remember. Monday, my father says to me, "You're not going out." And I use that as an excuse the second day, I have to go to school. When my dad says to me, "Why are you doing it?" I said, "You told me not to go out."
Right. Because it is a very open-ended statement.
It's a very open statement. Like, right. You're not going out. You're not doing this. There has to be a beginning and end. For example, the parent says, "You're not going out today." Right?
Right.
You're going to your room from now until, I don't know, like 5 o'clock. So there has to be a beginning and an end.
So be some boundaries child can understand, right?
Exactly. There has to be a point. Well, because like I said, sometimes the child himself might use it for his own advantage, like I did in my example. I used it for my advantage. Like, I didn't go to school for a whole day, and I was so happy. I'm always excited. And my father was like, "You told me to go." He's like, "But you, I'm like, "Nope, that's what I understood."
And it's only fair.
It's only fair. He said, "Not to go out, I'm not going out."
Right.
So there has to be, when you want to punish, there always have to be prerequisites. There have to be beginning and an end to what you want to discipline the child with. Don't leave an open statement. You're not playing PlayStation games. You're not taking the phone.
And that itself, it creates like a black hole in the mind of the child's life. For how long? And sometimes because the parents don't say it, they find a very strong response from the child. For example, if I say to the child, I'm taking your tablet away from you. The child, he's constantly, what he will be faced with is like a black hole of unknownness.
Right.
It's like, okay, so he's taking, my life is ending. That's it. But if I say, I'm taking a tablet for 2 minutes. I'm taking it for 10 minutes.
They can handle it.
They can handle it. Okay, you know what? After 10 minutes, I'm going to get it back.
Right.
So he knows. But when I do it without a beginning, without an end, that's very distracting.
Right.
So parents have to understand that is a very important
That's why
principle.
In some prisons I'm at, in the different countries of the world, if a person is sentenced to prison, he knows for how long.
Mm.
Even if they are on... but then that's why some people say people who are on death punishment, they should also know when they are going to be executed beforehand and not just surprise them.
Exactly, because it gives you at least, look, like you mentioned, the prison system, right? He's in prison for life. But for example, they say to him, you're in prison for three life sentences.
Right.
So they give it a number to make it easier for him.
Right.
Yeah, to make it easier for him to actually. He knows he's going to be there forever.
Right.
But just having that three-term sentences, maybe in his mind, because his mind plays tricks on you. Maybe he's like, okay, you know what? Maybe I couldn't manage to.
There's some hope here.
There's a hope that I could live three life sentences.
Yeah. But it's so cruel to imprison somebody and not tell them for how long.
Exactly. So it's very important that the child himself, when he's been disciplined, I mean, like you said, even adults, we want to have that time frame.
Right.
How about a child? Child needs it even more than an adult. All right. So parents need to understand that they have to make sure that when they punish, to keep all these rules, I mean, we're up to 11, to keep them all in their mind before making any sudden change or make any quick decision to punish their children.
And on that very important note, we'll unfortunately have to end today's program. I thank the Sayyid for his time, and I thank the dear listeners for tuning in. As usual, if our dear listeners have any questions, feedback, they can contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir, or they can find us on the various social media websites that are around there, such as on Facebook or Instagram, under the call sign of Call of Islam Radio. Thank you for tuning in.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. Dear
brothers and sisters, you're listening to The Spring of Truth from IRIB English Radio. I invite you to listen to a short part of the book Sirr Salat, The Secret of Prayer, written by Imam Khomeini. Some of the knowledgeable men comment that Bismillah refers to appeared, namely existence appeared by Bismillah. This confirms with the knowledgeable men of conduct and mysticism uttering that the entire beings, the particles of existence and the visible and invisible realm of manifestations of the whole encompassing name of God, namely the supreme name of God, the greatest name, therefore name which means sign and mark or zenith and attitude, is God's effusive and actual manifestations being. For due to this conduct, the entire of house of realization as from the abstract. From thy punishment I appeal to thy forgiveness, and from thy fairly to thy satisfaction, and from thee I appeal to thyself.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And you are listening to Spring of Truth coming to you from IRIB English Radio. So stay tuned with us. I am your host, Abdullah Al-Musawi, an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qom. We are looking at Imam Khomeini's point of view when it comes to Ashura. Imam Khomeini was quoted saying, "Others go to the mosques, listen to the sermon, and hear what is being preached. But when time comes for lamentation, they leave. This is because they do not know the significance of lamentation and the eulogies for the infallibles. It is these mourning gatherings that have saved and preserved the altar and the pulpit." Which is a very quiet point Imam makes, because this is still happening until today. After many, many years of the demise of Imam Khomeini, many people, they come to the masjid or to the Husseini, they listen to the lecture, and straight away, once it's finished, they leave. Look, I'm just here for the logic. I don't care about the crying. I don't care about the chest beating. I don't care about the lamenting. Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum. The Imam says to them, "You don't understand that you were only able to come to these majalis and listen and learn because the people before you cried and lamented. That's how it started. And in order for me and you to keep this going for generations to come, we need to participate and take care of this crying and lamenting for the Imam. So when you stand in a masjid or in the Husseini and you beat your chest, you're making a statement. You're teaching the generations to come that you need to keep this going, because this is the fuel for the lecture that you've just listened. This is what made the pulpit a pulpit. This is what made it stand. If it wasn't for this crying and for this what we call sha'a'ir, the signs of Ashura and the signs of Karbala and all these things that we do, then Karbala wouldn't be here."
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
This is the teacher. We will tell you the story of the martyrs of the sacred defense of Iran.
خدا انشالله رحمت کنه شهید عزیزمون مرحوم شهید اورنسی رو، یا همونطور که عرض کردیم استاد حسین اورنسی رو.
May Allah bless the soul of Shahid Abdul Hussein Bransi.
شهداؤنا تاريخنا، شهداؤنا كل أمجادنا.
Our martyrs are the makers of history. Our martyrs are a glory. Our martyrs are the spoken words of
the Prophet of Guidance, peace be upon him, and his holy progeny said, "The life of the world is like dipping your finger in the sea and bringing it out."
Today's story, the life and character of Shahid Abdul Hussein Bransi. Dear listeners, one of the great martyrs of the Iranian sacred defense is Shahid Abdul Hussein Bransi, who due to his agility and skillfulness in combat was known as Bruce Lee by the Iraqis. Shahid Bransi was a man who, since the time he was a child until the time of his death, treaded the path of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam and wanted nothing but their satisfaction. Shahid Bransi was born in 1942 in a village close to the city of Torbat Haydariye, which is a city near Mashhad, Khorasan province, Iran. Ever since Shahid Bransi was a child, he had the spirit of antagonizing disbelief and rebellion. For instance, when he was in fourth grade, owing to the inappropriate behavior of one of the anti-Islamic teachers and the unsuitable atmosphere of his school, he left school.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program, The Teacher. Shahid Bransi was very active politically and culturally during the movement of Imam Khomeini, which led to the victory of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Shahid Bransi got married in 1969 into a religious and clerical family, and this was another beginning for his persistent fight against the despotic regime of the Shah. As the struggle against the regime of the Shah reached its climax, Shahid Bransi had to move to Mashhad along with his family. Shahid Bransi began working as a builder in Mashhad. After the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Shahid Bransi entered the SWAT team of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. And now, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei talks about Shahid Boronsi.
خدا انشالله رحمت کنه شهید عزیزمون مرحوم شهید بورنسی رو یا همدور که عرض کردیم استاد حسین بورنسی.
May Allah bless the soul of Shahid Abdul Hussein Boronsi. Shahid Boronsi was neither a doctor nor a professor, but a simple bricklayer who was called Ustad Abdul Hussein, meaning the master bricklayer. However, he had such a deep understanding of the situation in Iran before the Islamic Revolution, and thus he was very much active in the struggles against the Pahlavi regime. After the Islamic Revolution of Iran, he entered the battlefields of the imposed Iraqi war on Iran. Now we know that during the 8-year sacred defense era of Iran, no one entered the battlefields as a commander. All were simple soldiers who, based upon their intelligence and sincerity, could reach higher ranks such as a general or a commander.
بعد می دیدن آدم قابلی است می شد فرمانده گروهان یا فرمانده دسته بعد می شد فرمانده گردان بعد می شد فرمانده تیپ می رفت بالا
Now, Shahid Abbas al-Musawi talks about the status of the martyrs.
شهداؤنا تاريخنا شهداؤنا كل أمجادنا شهداؤنا هم قرآننا الناطق.
Our martyrs are the makers of history. Our martyrs are a glory. Our martyrs are the spoken words of Quran. Our martyrs are the sons of Imam al-Hussein, who are the way Imam al-Hussein willed them to be. Our martyrs are Habib ibn Malahir. Our martyrs are Zuhair ibn Ghain. This is who the martyrs of our time are. Look at the way they look at you. They see us, but we don't see them. Through their souls, they are looking at their mothers, fathers, and at us all in a transparent manner. But as for us, the delusions of the materialistic world and our attachment to it, to our dismay, we are unable to see them.
Welcome back, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program, The Teacher. During the Iran-Iraq War, Shahid Boronsi was not one of those proud commanders who would order his subordinates what to do. In fact, he was very humble and would even wash the dishes behind the fronts. One of the fellow combatants of Shahid Boronsi says that while he was washing the dishes, he would go to and fro doing other tasks related to his commandership, such as reconnaissance, deploying troops, and dismissing them, and so on and so forth. However, Shahid Boronsi would not give the task of washing the dishes and distributing food among soldiers to someone else. Someone came and started washing the dishes instead of him. But Shahid Boronsi, with so much compassion, patted him on the back and said, "Thank you for bringing the dishes to the sink. Now let me do the rest of the work." That person insisted, but Shahid Boronsi refused and said that he would do the job himself. And now, Sister Zainab reads to us an excerpt of the last will of today's Shaheed.
The Prophet of Guidance, peace be upon him, and his holy progeny said, "The life of the world is like dipping your finger in the sea and bringing it out. How much water have you taken from the sea? Have you recognized how much of the seawater you have taken? You must pay attention to the fact that the world is like this compared to the hereafter. Man must understand how great the world of the hereafter is, and the blessings that are there for those who follow the path of the prophets. No one can describe them with the tongue and with words. These few days of the world is not worth your going astray and exerting useless effort for material means. My children, I instruct you to pray the same way that Luqman instructed his son. Establish prayer, enjoin the good and forbid evil."
Thank you so much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of The Teacher, which was about Shahid Boronsi. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com and click on the link, The Call of Islam, to listen to this program as well as our other programs. Until next time, we leave you in Allah's care.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters all around the world, Assalamu alaikum and welcome to Q&A on Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio. In this series of shows, we are trying to touch and talk about some, let's say, questions or misunderstandings which are being asked by different questioners about the theological issues and any questions regarding the religious concepts. For this, we invite Islamic researchers and scholars from Qom Seminary Schools to help us with the answers. That's why